On this podcast, you'll find interviews with high-performing, successful individuals in life sciences. On a weekly basis, we cover their proven methods, principles, strategies, and mindsets to implement new technologies that scale to meet the needs of people in our world.
Welcome to this episode of Life Science Success. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Don, and I'm a consultant in life sciences and a digital marketer. And before we get started with our interview today, just a quick word from our sponsor.
This episode of Life Science Success is brought to you by D3 Digital Media Marketing. Dive into the digital world with confidence and creativity on your side. D3 Digital Media Marketing is your all-in-one solution for making a lasting impact online. From the vibrant, engaging world of social media marketing, podcasts and webinars, to the strategic depths of website development, SEO, pay-per-click, email, and content marketing, we tailor our approach to fit your unique brand story. Let's elevate your presence, connect with your audience, and drive success together. Your digital journey starts here. Visit d3digitalmedia.com to learn more.
In this episode of Life Science Success, my guest is Dan Lunds. Dan is the CEO and co-founder of Previse, a pioneering company based in Baltimore, Maryland that specializes in offering tests for the prediction and earlier detection of upper GI cancers. Welcome, Dan.
Don, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being here. I've done an awful lot of work in diagnostics myself, and so I'm really interested in this topic and kind of hearing about your journey. So, would you mind just maybe starting off though, just telling us a little bit about what led you to the point of becoming the CEO of Previse, and what was your career before then?
Yeah, so. I guess I'll start with the latter. So a little bit about my background. I grew up in the Baltimore area. I told you I'm still in Baltimore. After high school, I joined the Marine Corps, spent 7 years in the Marines. And after my time in the Marines, I had my first exposure, what I would call my real exposure to healthcare as a patient in the VA medical system. And that's really where it's amazing because when I started off my journey in the Marines, it was more about me being an 18-year-old kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. And I would have said, oh yeah, serving. But it was really through my time in the Marines and then my time as a patient where I found a passion and what I feel like is a purpose for serving others. So after that, I went on and got my undergrad in kinesiology, my MBA from Johns Hopkins, and worked in research in interventional pulmonology at Johns Hopkins before transitioning to a broader, more CRO type role at Johns Hopkins within the clinical research network. And that's where I met my co-founder, Dr. Steven Meltzer. He's an accomplished biomarker researcher, gastroenterologist, professor of medicine and oncology at Johns Hopkins. And we started looking at this incredible technology that he had developed that he said he felt like could really help patients and potentially save lives. And it was really through this parallel purpose of wanting to serve others that brought us together. So we spent some time looking at customer discovery, really seeing if this might be something that's viable in the market, ultimately determined that it was. And I would say at that time I became a tenacious, not very experienced founder and ultimately CEO of Previse.
Yeah, and so in terms of the journey that you took, what were some of the pivotal moments that you felt, really kind of guided that point of, putting you in the position that you're in today?
Yeah, so a few points. One, I would say through my journey through the Marines, learning humility, learning perseverance, and learning how to lead by example, coming to an understanding that, the mission comes first. And ultimately, if we really want to serve, if we really want to take care of others, we've got to figure out, okay, how do we achieve the mission and what our purpose is as an organization? then transitioning out of the Marines and the wonderful mentors I had in the Marines, but then beyond, and leaders who taught me empathy, taught me tenacity and again, perseverance and pushing through failures. And I remember a mentor telling me, hey, fail your way to success, you know, which is certainly something in the startup world and in starting an organization, you face a lot of no's, whether it's through investors or, you know, we've been able to achieve SBIRs and STTRs and different NIH grants. But when you're going through submitting grants and publications, there's a lot of no's on your journey and learning how to persevere through that. And again, I'll just touch on the humility piece and learning how to ask for help. Coming to an understanding that especially in the life sciences realm, you're not going to know everything. Mm-hmm. And while you may develop a broad understanding as a CEO, and maybe you have a deep understanding in some areas, amongst the technology and the challenges of the technology and developing research studies to look at analytical, clinical validity and clinical utility, getting into the reimbursement realm, and ultimately then getting into the market, the sales and marketing side, there's no way to know everything. And being able to ask for help, ask for guidance, finding the right people and the right resources to be able to lead the company to success and ultimately get that product out to patients, to serve patients and hopefully improve outcomes.
Yeah, I feel like, it's, you know, I know as researchers are creating drugs, right? I mean, they run into an awful lot of the same sort of things. And then on the diagnostic side, back to your, you know, the whole idea of whenever you run into these major challenges, having somebody that one has been there and sort of, you know, untangled the knot of, you know, some of the difficulties that I would say that you can run into in terms of developing a diagnostic. And a lot of the diagnostics anymore are complex. I mean, they have, you know, bioinformatics pipelines in addition to the, you know, the actual, you know, analyte that you're using to test and things like that. I mean, all of those things sort of add to the complexity, I feel like, you know, inside of any organization. Would you mind just sort of, you know, talking a little bit about the previous roles that you've had and some of the, you know, the ways that they've prepared you for leading Previse?
Yeah, so I'm going to start at Johns Hopkins and working in research in a field called interventional pulmonology. And interventional pulmonology is I would say still an up-and-coming field. It's a very specialized field, doing a lot of advanced diagnostic procedures or a lot of advanced procedures that really introduced me to clinical trials, clinical trial design, the challenges of getting key stakeholders involved, how to budget for this, and how to ensure that you're seeking out the right outcomes and asking the right questions to get to those right answers and endpoints for that clinical trial. This is where my first exposure happened for clinical trials for medical devices, therapeutics, and diagnostics. And it allowed me to see it, you know, through many stakeholder eyes and working with many different stakeholders, starting first with the patient and the patient walking through this vulnerable time. It's something, because many times from the desk I sit at now, it's easy to look at, okay, what's the N need to be for this study? Okay, we're trying to achieve 2,000 patients for this study and we need this for our endpoint. Then to dive in with the statisticians and look and say, okay, are we achieving the results we need to, or what are we seeing in the data? But it's easy to look at it as a data point. Working at Johns Hopkins, it allowed me in that role to actually work with these patients, these individuals, these families, oftentimes walking through one of the most challenging and vulnerable points. A lot of, you know, when we were working on the diagnostics project, it was for a large life sciences company that had launched a diagnostic for lung cancer detection. Mm-hmm. And these patients were walking through oftentimes the most difficult diagnosis and filled with, you know, I can only imagine filled with fear and uncertainty and, you know, confusion with a lot of questions. It was quite incredible because it also allowed me to have a front row seat for this short snippet of time that they were at the, you know, maybe at their bronchoscopy or at their procedure, but to see how it brought people together, how families would hold on to one another, and the hope and the purpose that they lived with and the perspective that they had. So I would start there with that empathy piece and leading with empathy. And as a life sciences leader that you know, oftentimes dealing with so many different pressures and you know, so many different, oh, we've got to achieve this milestone. We've got to do this to get to our next fundraise or to get this product to its next point. Being able to come back and recognize, I think most of us in this field, you know, get into it because, hey, we want to serve others. We have a passion for people and for science. And how do we further things? How do we improve outcomes? How do we help people? So really starting with that empathy piece and then going back and again, with my time in the Marines and my time at Hopkins, learning perseverance, how to walk through failures, how to lead by example and really be in the trenches with the team pushing forward, and how having that humility and perseverance to find the right answers, to find the right people that can guide you, and recognizing that you're not going to know everything, but you can find people. You know, we joke here that we don't have to rewrite every book. We can find the writers or the readers of that book and allow them to guide us to those right answers.
Yeah, it's such an important thing, because I feel like the things that seem to really help people, if you really sort of listen to the end thread of a lot of successful companies, they come together because of the brilliant people that they've surrounded themselves with. And then, you know, oftentimes, you know, just, you know, overcoming one particular challenge can involve an awful lot of minds to try and figure out, okay, so how specifically do we overcome this? And it's not always the, you know, the one leader, the one chief technology officer or whatever. It's more often the team that surrounds them. And so, you know, to give a lot of credit to the folks that are, you know, way down on the bench that are doing a lot of the, you know, base level science, but also the mid-level minds, you know, in between that as well, that, you know, aren't always recognized. But I feel like there's just so many people that are involved in these things and ensuring that they're successful.
Absolutely. And it all starts and it all ends with people. And that's whether it's the patients, the physicians, the team that we work with. And while I get to sit here like on this podcast and talk to you, I'm not the star of the team with Improvise. It's everything that we achieve is because of the, you know, the people that surround me and the people that are pushing forward in the different areas. And so without my team, there wouldn't be Improvise.
Yeah, that's a great lead in. So tell us a little bit about what sets Improvise apart from other companies in the life sciences sector.
Yeah, so starting with the science, we're currently focused in upper GI diseases. And you know, when you think of different GI diseases, and we're going to start with cancer and think about cancer a little bit, you know, oftentimes for good reason, there's a lot of attention and focus given to colon cancer, and which is a tragic cancer and you know, affects so many people. But up at the other end, up in the esophagus, there's a lethal cancer. In fact, it's the second most lethal cancer when you look at 5-year survival. And this is esophageal cancer, cancer of the esophagus. And it's really increased in prevalence. In fact, over the last 40 years, it's increased in prevalence 700%. And it, you know, it's believed that this is possibly because of the link to GERD or chronic acid reflux. And chronic acid reflux, I'm going to jump out there and call it an epidemic. It's something that affects 1 in 5 people in the United States. And there's many different diseases within the upper GI when you look from the stomach to the esophagus. But that's really where we found our focus to be. And this is an area of focus for Dr. Meltzer and his research. And when we look at what sets us apart and what we're doing, we're really focused on the prevention side. Starting off with this high-risk population, this 10 to 15% of patients with this chronic acid reflux who have this condition called Barrett's esophagus. And Barrett's esophagus is this pre-malignant condition that develops, this precancerous condition that develops and puts a patient at an up to 50 times more likely chance of developing esophageal cancer. So we're focused on risk stratification of these patients. So there's a number of amazing tools, and we're doing research on our own tools to detect Barrett's esophagus early. But once a patient is diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus, and the diagnosis ultimately occurs through upper endoscopy, and there's different screening modalities for detecting this Barrett's esophagus, but they're put on a lifetime surveillance program. And the question becomes, okay, what is the likelihood of this patient progressing? What should the interval be, the interval of surveillance be for this patient? Should we move forward with endoscopic treatment, something called ablation? You know, is this patient lower risk? Can we reduce the anxiety for this patient and have this patient come in less frequently? So we look at what's called epigenetics, methylation, and we bring in that patient's standard of care biopsy from one of their endoscopies. We run it through our assay. We look at specific genes, then we run it through our algorithm, and we're able to risk stratify that patient and give that patient a 5-year risk score for their likelihood of progressing to what's called high-grade dysplasia or cancer. And both of these are treatment endpoints, high-grade dysplasia, and of course, cancer, informing that GI physician of what steps to take next, whether that be, hey, this patient is higher risk, we're going to move them towards treatment, or this patient is lower risk, we can, you know, within clinical guidelines, maybe reduce the frequency of their surveillance from 3 years to 5 years. And we've been able to do that through the incredible science that Dr. Meltzer has developed with a high sensitivity and at a low cost.
And can you tell us at what stage are you at today? So is the diagnostic fully released today, or are there things that you're currently working on to release it?
No, so it is commercially available. It's called EsoPredict, and it is being used in a number of practices throughout the United States. It's really been quite incredible, the reception we've had going out to GI physicians and working with GI physicians. It really fulfills a clinical need, an area, a pain point for physicians, because there you know, are limited ways to be able to risk stratify patients. And each of those kind of comes at the detriment of the sensitivity. It's a real sensitivity issue when looking at the performance of the different methods out there, specifically trying to pick up that dysplasia through pathology. So we are a commercially available test.
Perfect. And so what does the future look like? I mean, are you continuing to build, you know, additional diagnostics? Are you, what's the future provide?
Yeah, so our focus right now is commercially making EsoPredict more accessible for patients throughout the United States. And then we have a pipeline of technologies. So we have non-endoscopic tools. We have our own medical device for picking up cells to test for diseases such as Barrett's esophagus detection, moving EsoPredict to a non-endoscopic platform to allow that for surveillance and risk stratifying patients, picking up different diseases, including cancers. So we have a number of studies ongoing that are NIH funded in collaboration with the Early GI Biomarker Laboratory at Johns Hopkins. So a robust and exciting pipeline of technologies. We're getting exciting data and really eager to move those along to continue to serve patients.
Can you tell me, I mean, along the way, I would imagine that there were breakthroughs or recent, you know, recent achievements that you have to be extremely, you know, proud of. Can you tell me about something that stands out in your mind?
Yeah. So actually, quite recently started receiving payment back from claims to insurance companies and starting to achieve some of our milestones on the market access front. So when we're starting off Previse, it's easy. I'll speak for myself as a first time, you know, founder getting out there to really be focused on, okay, technology. How do we get the technology here? How do we, you know, conduct the right, and coming from academia, clinical validation, thinking about, okay, clinical validation. You know, kind of not giving the attention early on to clinical utility and market access that really were a key area that should have early attention. We were able to bring on a wonderful outcomes and market access leader, and really achieve some valuable milestones with market access, with our clinical utility studies. And we're starting to see the fruits of that through claims being paid for ESO Predict. So that's been quite exciting.
Yeah, I would imagine so. But I also would imagine that there is a transition that every organization goes through, to your point about, you know, being very focused on sort of the tactical science that has to be done, and then eventually the clinical studies that have to be done, and then eventually the, like you said, the market access, and how eventually are we going to get paid? I know in recent conversations that I've had with investors, even, you know, they sort of lead you to that that end point of, okay, so what does reimbursement look like? Very early now, because of some of the, you know, the risks that they've seen with other companies. But at the same time, it's hard to fairly paint that full picture of what it will look like until you really know on the back end, what exactly does this thing look like, and what is it running on, and how, you know, can it serve the patients the way that you've sort of set out in the very beginning? You know, this whole journey is not something that, you know, that is very easy for many organizations as well.
No, and you bring up a wonderful point, and I'm so grateful for the guidance I had working at, you know, Johns Hopkins with Johns Hopkins Tech Ventures, and they have a program, an incubator called Fast Forward for Technologies coming out of Hopkins, and we were able to do what's called the NIH iCORE program. And this is all about customer discovery. So one of the first things that Dr. Melter and myself did is we got into this iCORE program, didn't know much about iCORE or what we'd be doing, but it's all about customer discovery and getting out and talking to the key stakeholders. And they had wonderful mentors who guided us and said, hey, let's get out and talk to, you know, the most obvious initially is GI physicians and patients. But then as we worked through the process, it was like, okay, wait a second, this is uncovering different stakeholders we have to work with, physician stakeholders such as pathologists, where we're getting the samples from, and what are the logistics going to look like here? What's the value proposition for the pathology labs who have to put in the work to find the samples that we're going to be testing? What about the payer stakeholders who may be looking through the outcomes lens and through the financial lens, and how do you achieve an answer? You know, how do you first find the correct questions to ask? And then how do you start to develop those hypotheses and go out and test and iterate to get those right data points? And how do you, you know, another thing that I look at with the clinical validation, and something early on that was a wonderful lesson for me to go through, is it's one thing to develop the data and say, okay, this is our sensitivity, this is our specificity, you know, NPV, PPV, like these different endpoints or different data points. However, we've got a test that has to be used in the clinic, and you've got a busy physician, oftentimes overworked physician population, who is seeing many different patients, who might have a very large caseload of patients. And how do you present this data? How do you present the data in a way that is usable in the clinic, that the physician can quickly look at this, sometimes while a patient is sitting in front of them, and say, okay, this is the information I need. This makes sense to move in, you know, to use along with this clinical information to serve this patient. So it's often, it's also so, so important to think through, how do we present this data?
Yeah. Especially so that it comes through, that, you know, you want obviously to paint the full picture of where you are, but also, make sure that people understand at the end of the day where exactly, you are and the impact that the diagnostic can have, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's correct. It's within Barrett's esophagus surveillance. It's interesting because as we went out and we started talking to physicians, oftentimes we'd hear, hey, we'd like green light, red light. And you know, you think of almost like a Cologuard where it's a positive or negative, a binary answer. But when you're looking at prognostics and looking out 5 years or 10 years, looking out into the future, and when you look at surveillance programs and the clinical guidelines, there's high risk can mean different things in the patient management. So it may mean, hey, we're going to, you know, increase surveillance and have this patient come back in 6 months or come back in a year. Or it could mean, hey, let's move forward with treatment. Same thing on the low risk, and it's you're dealing with unique patient interactions and unique, you know, biological individuals and who have different thoughts about their own treatment and different concerns and possibly fears. And on the low risk end, it could mean something where it's like, yeah, let's stick to the standard of care versus, yeah, let's extend out to the, you know, I call it the boundary point of the clinical guidelines and move to 5 years surveillance intervals. So helping that physician to have the simplicity to be able to, you know, look, having the data so simple to be able to look at, a report so simple, but also that gives that deeper insight to help them make those decisions within that, let's call it green light, red light kind of realm.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dan, what's the greatest leadership advice that you've ever received?
So two pieces, and I mentioned them through the talk, but failing your way to success, becoming okay with failure, developing the humility to walk through failure and ask for help and recognize when it's an area that you just don't know about. It's like a leader's job is not to always have the right answers or always know everything. It's a leader's job to work alongside their team and to help find the right answers and be able to go and ask for help and to be able to really work alongside people and keep things moving forward through the failures and the challenges. And then also leading by example. Here at Previse, you know, we may have our different titles, but everyone does everything. You know, one of our first investors, a gentleman, Brandon DeWitt, he was the founder of a successful company called MX, a financial technologies company. And they had this wonderful saying of, if not me, then who? And if not now, then when? So when you see something, being able to take action, being able to step up, and that could be anything from, you know, seeing a mess and picking up, you know, grabbing a broom and picking it up, or seeing somebody overwhelmed in a certain area and saying, hey, I'll spend some extra time, you know, this evening working with you. Let's walk through it together. Even if it's an area I don't know, like, hey, I'm here with you, you know, like you put me to work with whatever you need or, you know, got a shoulder for you if you need, but really living through leadership by example and being a part of the team. And I think those are the two of the key points that I would say that have really been important to me as a leader.
Thank you for sharing that. What inspires you?
Yeah, so I what really inspires me is people. And stories, and especially the individual stories. It's I told you about my experience working at Johns Hopkins as in the research realm and being exposed to patients, but they're personally going through a journey. A good friend of mine her son, his name was Mo. He was a cancer patient who was diagnosed as an infant, and spent about 75% of his life in the hospital, and just went through, you know, what I think most of us would call just a tragic, just so challenging journey. And Mo had an infectious laugh. He was, you know, such a kid, like just had that spirit and a positivity. And he would talk about being positive each day. And he really had this gratitude for life and the people around him. And it was infectious, and it taught me so much. And actually, when we were talking about, when you start a company like this, in my experience, it kind of starts with the back of the envelope kind of idea, and then the internal look and discussions of, all right, are we ready to take on something 0 to 1, like kind of, you know, to go and do what it takes to make this real. And he was really the inspiration for me taking that leap was Mo. So Mo passed away at a young age, at the age of 16, but he touched so many lives in the Baltimore area, and personally really touched my life. I really had the honor of being able to spend a lot of time with him, because he was a patient at Johns Hopkins, and because of my relationship with his mother, and being able to just go spend time and really gain so much from his spirit and his perseverance and his gratitude for life and his purpose, you know, his purpose driven attitude for life. So I would say Mo personally for me was a big inspiration in me taking this leap, and somebody I often think back to.
Well, thank you for sharing that. What concerns you?
Yeah. So when it comes to Previse, when it comes to kind of this ecosystem, one of the challenges that we face, and I'll specifically focus on the diagnostics realm, is that oftentimes the external, ecosystem doesn't necessarily keep up with the changes in the technology and the rapid changes that are happening in advances in science and bringing things to market. So that might be on the regulatory front and regulators and doing their important work to protect patients and ensure efficacy. But figuring out how to respond with tests that, you know, especially tests that may use AI or tests that may get to answers in different ways, or may, you know, be for multiple indications or multiple disease states. So on the regulatory front, and then also on the reimbursement front, looking at outcomes and okay, what does clinical utility mean? Is it decision impact, just seeing how it changes the management of that patient, how the physician uses it to change the management of that patient? Or is it looking more longitudinally and okay, what are the outcomes changes and how's it improving outcomes? And the changing landscape there is as payers are working and iterating and developing kind of their guidance, I'd say, in how to achieve coverage determinations, both public and private payers. So I would say the evolving landscape, which is also part of the excitement in this, is especially being in a younger company, is being able to quickly pivot, being able to go out there and truly understand where things are at today and how to respond and where things may be going. But I'd say that's always a concern. And finally, I'd say on the, you know, kind of concern front is always thinking about, okay, is what we're providing, is this really adding benefit for physicians and ultimately patients, and always keeping that in the front of mind and never getting to a place of comfort where we say, okay, look, look at our numbers. We're achieving numbers. So it must mean it's helping people. But, you know, always keeping that front of mind of, is this really setting out and benefiting patients, not just being a cost, not just, you know, out there driving a business and revenue, but are we truly serving patients, truly serving physicians in the best way that we can?
That last point is something that I actually just recently ran into as well. I had somebody I was working with that, you know, more or less was saying the same thing. You know, they were showing me, you know, how they were checking the box every day. And I said, yeah, but I don't really care about that. I want to see the outcome, you know, measured as well, right? Whether or not if we're actually having the end level, you know, impact is really more important than checking the box every day. I don't, you know, a lot of us do a lot of work during a day, but that doesn't necessarily mean that traction is actually happening right behind the scenes. And it's such an important point as well. Last question, what excites you?
Yeah, so being able to get out there and serve patients as you know, has kind of been a theme throughout this talk. It's you know, I have the opportunity to work along such incredible people and incredible minds in our team here at Previse and in the external stakeholders and the physicians that we work with. And you know, I received a text message last week from a GI physician down in Florida who had used our test, and he had used some different technologies previously on a patient that he was really concerned about. This patient had 17 centimeters of Barrett's esophagus, which is considered ultra long segment. I mean, this is a lot of Barrett's, and he was really concerned about this patient. And through the other tools he had used, you know, really wasn't able to get the answers that he was seeking. And our test came back and said that this patient had a 20% risk of progressing to high grade or cancer in the next 5 years, something we call high risk. And he was able to move forward and discuss it with the patient and do ablation treatment for this patient, which is often curative treatment for this patient that, you know, possibly, we'll never know, but possibly prevented a cancer case from occurring. And that's really what drives me, what drives us here and really excites us is seeing this type of impact and getting back that feedback that, hey, we were able to move forward and serve this patient in this way and take this action with this patient. And ultimately, you know, again, potentially prevent a cancer. That's really what excites me.
Truly exciting as well. Well, Dan Lunds, thank you so much for being a guest on the Life Science Success Podcast. I greatly appreciate you being here. And yeah, for all of those people that are out there that are suffering from, you know, GERD today, and then eventually you're having to go see a GI physician and things like that, how important is it to have, you know, just, you know, more firm answers in terms of what's going on? So thank you for all the work that you've been doing. I greatly appreciate it.
No, Don, thank you. And actually, real quick, if you don't mind, it's Esophageal Cancer Awareness Month. And there's a wonderful organization called the Esophageal Cancer Awareness Network, ECAN. So please, if you have questions or are seeking some guidance, go check out ECAN and the wonderful tools and resources they have.
Oh, thank you so much. And all of Dan's information will be on the Life Science Success website for you to link to Dan and connect to Dan. And so thanks again, and I greatly appreciate you being on.
Thank you for having me, Don.
Thank you for listening to Life Science Success. For complete details about this podcast, including show notes, how to get in touch with guests, and more episodes, please visit www.lifesciencesuccess.com. If there's someone you'd like for us to invite to the show as a guest, please let me know by sending me a message at the podcast website. Please click subscribe on your favorite podcast app, share the podcast, or tell a friend about it. And last but not least, rate the podcast. Thank you again.